Okay, so now it's my honor to introduce Hayao Mayer. Hayao fled Nazi Germany alone when he was 14 years old. He was a refugee for 3 years and tried to continue his studies, ended up in the Netherlands. Eventually, he went underground and lived in the underground and supported the resistance for a year before he was betrayed. He eventually ended up in Auschwitz, where he spent 10 months until Auschwitz was liberated by the Russians. After liberation, he made his way back to the Netherlands, and there he continued his education and eventually became the head of research for Philips Electronics. After retirement, Hayao went on to make custom violins and violas for concert players. And today he spends most of his time writing, speaking, and being active on Palestine. So please join me in welcoming Hayao Mayer.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you all for coming in such great numbers. And I want to start with a true anecdote. I'm 86 years old, so I've had a long life. And we saw outside the Zionists standing with their flags. And we must be extremely grateful to this church and to the Reverend that we're here inside, because a few years ago I was to read from one of my books in a church in Frankfurt, Germany, and the chairman of the Jewish synagogue in Frankfurt had written to his people, now this chap Mayer comes, and please go with Israeli flags to the church and make it impossible. And the church had, in the contract, had when difficulties arise, the contract is null and void, so we had to stand outside. But then I had a nice experience. There I was standing, my publisher had brought a megaphone, and I could talk to the masses outside with their flags. And when it had a bit calmed down, I said, "Oh, I'm so glad that you're here in such a great number with your Israeli flags, because this reminds me the first time that I wanted to give a talk, and that was made impossible by people who stormed the room where I was going to speak as a 10-year-old boy for Purim festival, and they stormed the room with their flags in hand, and that was the stormtroopers, the Nazi stormtroopers. So I said, you are now the second time that this occurs to me, and I think your predecessors deserve this worthy followers." So, and this is And this will probably be now in a distorted way in the papers, but I can under oath say that this is exactly true, both these events I went through. Okay. Now, I was asked to talk about the misuse of the Holocaust in the dispossession of Palestine, and we had the beautiful introduction by Dr. Hutton, and the Islamophobia he mentioned is exactly what you see here in the United States, but also, unfortunately, in my country, in the Netherlands. It reminds me also of my youth. Islamophobes apply the same technique of dehumanization, diabolization, and not seeing the individual, but talking about we and them, like I underwent in Nazi Germany, and because I couldn't go to school anymore there, I was until November 38, I could go to just a public German school, but then after November 38, Jews were forbidden there, and therefore I had to go to Holland. Now, the Holocaust is here invoked because it's so highly misused. But please note, I think also Hatem mentioned it, Shulamit Aloni, the former Minister of Education in Israel, once wrote an article, you don't need gas chambers to commit genocide, because there are many, many forms of genocide. And I go so far as to say that even preventing young people who want to learn from accessing admission to their school is a slow motion form of genocide. And I'm afraid I'm afraid this happens on a nearly daily basis somewhere or in many parts in Palestine. And therefore we must all protest this type of policy. Now, Sarah mentioned that many forms of genocide to do with gas chambers. But Sarah mentioned one very important thing, and that is that one of the most important conclusions also of my talk will be that we are all equivalent and have the same dignity, and the evil starts, or the bad policy starts when we make distinctions between them and us and them. Okay. Now we come to this nice, friendly-looking man is Bibi Netanyahu, the present Prime Minister of Israel, and which calls itself, unfortunately, a Jewish state, but it's a Zionist state, and I will go into the large difference between the two. But what I want to insert here, just also like a note of humor, I don't know whether you are aware that the most cruel and most right-wing generals and politicians in Israel use very often their baby name. So he's not called Benjamin Netanyahu, no, Bibi. Okay, just like Ariel Sharon was also such a nice, humane general, he's called Arik. It is very, very strange observation. Okay, Bibi Netanyahu now had the temerity on a United Nations General Assembly not so long ago to invoke the number of our arms, the ex-Auschwitz prisoners, in order to justify an imminent attack on Iran. I can absolutely not see what that has to do with the number on my arm. And another example is indeed Sharon, who once, when asked, why don't you go back to the only frontiers of Israel, which are lawful, and this is the so-called Green Line, the Armistice Line of 1947, or 48, 47, I think. And he said, no, I don't intend to go back to Auschwitz or borders. What all these things, Iran or the borders of the country have to do with Auschwitz is a complete enigma to me. Now we come to the further arguments why this is a despicable misuse. First of all, it was only a few percent of German Jews who, before Hitler came, who were Zionists. They were German citizens of the Jewish creed, and they had fought, and I will come back to that, side by side as all Jews in modern countries which had a which had an Enlightenment view fought together with their non-Jewish comrades in the trenches of the First World War. And so there were Jews and not Zionists. And secondly, Zionism is very unsympathetic to the Holocaust victims. Ben-Gurion, you won't believe it, but it's absolutely true. Ben-Gurion referred to us, so the survivors of the annihilation camps, as useless human material. So here I stand, and you must now tolerate to be spoken to a while by a piece of useless human material. Congratulations. Then they spread the myth that we did not try to escape from or to avoid the camps, that we went to the slaughter like sheep to the slaughter. Nothing is more true. I mean, large masses couldn't find ways to opt out. But I would not stand here talking to you if I had not been underground for a year, because longer than 10 months nobody could survive in Auschwitz, and I just succeeded in that. And once more, the victims were Jews, not Zionists, and therefore I now come and explain to you what the vast difference is between Judaism and Zionism. Pre-World War II, Judaism in Central Europe especially, and also in the United States, that was the reform Jewish belief in the United States, were humanitarian and universalist. They had the many prescriptions an Orthodox Jew has to fulfill. They thought secondary. They had put the interhuman ethics in the center of that sort of Judaism. And that was the largest part of the Jews in Central Europe and in the States were of that creed. And I always, when I sometimes meet clergymen in theologians in Holland, and I say, yeah, the first Reform rabbi was Rabbi Joshua ben Yosef from Nazareth, called Jesus, and they agree. So because he did exactly the same, that's how Christianity came to exist. And this interhuman ethics is very clearly defined in Leviticus 19:34, and it reads, "The stranger which dwelleth amongst you, thou shalt treat as if he were born amongst you. Love thy neighbor, he is like you, also you have been a stranger in Egypt." And this ethics, interhuman ethics, was paraphrased 100 years before Christ by Rabbi Hillel, who was asked by somebody, can you tell me what the thick book of the Old Testament, especially the five books of Moses, can you paraphrase that in one sentence? And he said, yes, I can. What thou not wilt, that is called the golden rule with which I was educated too when I was a young kid. What thou not wilt, what thou hast done, don't to the others. And then he said, that is the whole essence of this Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. Okay. Unfortunately, I will say quite a number of things against Zionism. Unfortunately, now I have to say a negative thing, but with a positive aspect. I haven't said negative against Judaism, because the Jews in the world think that is, therefore the phrase is coined, and especially by Islamophobes, the Judeo-Christian ethics. But unfortunately for the Judeo-Christian ethics, especially for the Judean, but that was the first one, is that 500 years before Rabbi Hillel, exactly the same words of the Golden Rule were written down by the Chinese philosopher Confucius. And that is for Judaism, is a tiny bit sad, not very, but it proves a thing which I come back to again, that this interhuman ethics is a general human phenomenon, and actually it is modern research in biology has shown that it is implanted in our brain by evolution. And so every normal human being has feelings of empathy, and you need special methods in order to diminish it, but I come back to that. Now, political Zionism is exactly the opposite of this universalist humanitarian doctrine called liberal Judaism, ethical Judaism. That is, it is colonialist, it is racist, it is separatist, and it is based on completely different books, different parts of the Old Testament, especially the book Joshua, which in a sense is the father and mother of all cruel genocide. And it goes so far that destruction and mass murder of several Canaanitic cities are described there, and in one God is angry because somebody who has still empathy left wants to let a little baby not to murder a little baby, and then God is angry because that is very dangerous to let a little baby live. Okay. I talk here about political Zionism. It was already defined by Hatem, but I want to repeat once more. Political Zionism has a history from the early 20th century, or the end of 19th century, and I think 1897 was the first conference. From the 30s on, from the 1930s on, whereas it started out a bit diffuse with various factions, it became very monolithic. And that you see, left or right in Israel doesn't matter at all, because political Zionism, and that is Zionism which was practiced by the Israeli the politicians in Palestine, and which was from 48 was Israel, for the Jews, they have one single goal, and that is maximum amount of area in Palestine with a minimum amount, and if possible zero, of Palestinians. And as I say, Hatem gave examples of that. Now I come. How did the formation of Zionism come about? Well, around 1900, so around the turn of the century, from the 19th to 20th century, there was in many, many European countries a virulent anti-Semitism, and especially two. I will mention two: Russia and France. In Russia, you had Alexander III, who was a severe anti-Semite, and I still, as a kid, heard my parents talk. They were since generation in Germany, but they were so impressed by the fact that in 1903 there was a very bloody pogrom against Jews, and in Russia, and they and many, many Russian Jews fled to other parts of Europe, and also to England. And that had a very, very tragic consequence, because Mr. Balfour, the then-time foreign minister of foreign affairs in Great Britain, was also a severe anti-Semite, and he didn't want to see along his his window, from his window in Downing Street 10, he didn't want to see Russian Jews walk around. So he decided, well, why don't they go to Palestine? They're, according to the myth, there is where they come from. Okay, so that is, and that in this way, the notorious and infamous Balfour Declaration was set up, which robbed essentially the country from the Palestinians. And now we come to the founder of the Zionistic movement or Zionistic ideology, and that it was Theodor Herzl. And Theodor Herzl was a very highly assimilated Viennese Jew who was in Paris to report on another very dramatic anti-Semitic happening there. That was that a Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish captain who made part of the French military general staff. And we should note here that the emancipation of Jews in Europe had been initiated by Napoleon as a French emperor. So France was, through the French Revolution, had very modern views on the equivalence of all human beings, and so they had introduced the emancipation of Jews in Europe. And now Mr. Herzl was rightly appalled that out of all in France, they accused Mr. Dreyfus on the Captain Dreyfus on the basis of forged papers. And the one who discovered it and sorted it out was Émile Zola, the very famous French writer, and who wrote an article, "I accuse," and eventually Captain Dreyfus was fully rehabilitated. But being appalled was right of Herzl, but unfortunately Mr. Herzl, with all his being very European and assimilated, had assimilated in a different way. So there are two forms of assimilation. Assimilation to the society, and to assimilate thoughts and ideas. He had assimilated all the wrong thoughts which drifted about in Europe of the time as colonialism, nationalism, racism, and the idea of a nation state. And that was not only bad ideas, but some of them were very wrong. I mean, most of them are wrong, but one was factually wrong, namely, he thought, why are we Jews subject to anti-Semitism? And he thought, oh, we don't have a nation state. And so that's how the idea came about. And he would have accepted Madagascar or Kenya or so, which was proposed by the British. But the Russian Jews were much more traditional, and they said, no, nothing else than Palestine, and that is how it all came about. But it's a completely stupid, we now can prove that it's a stupid idea, because those of you who are old enough to know what happened immediately after the Second World War, that is that in Indonesia, once it was free from the Dutch colonialists, there were big pogroms against Chinese traders in Indonesia. And China is not very far away, but it didn't do anything about it. So having a nation state doesn't prevent that your ethnic brethren are maltreated in another country. So it's wrong. Now, we see, and I said that, and Hatem said it, and we all, I think most of us, agree here, that Israel does two very, very bad things, the state of Israel. It treats the Palestinians very inhumanely, and it doesn't give a damn about international law. And both are absolutely contrary, and especially the first one, the inhumane behavior, is against what I characterized as ethical Judaism. And so, in order not to come too much into contradiction with themselves, they accepted in quite a large numbers a new religion, and it is the Holocaust religion, which was created by High Priest Elie Wiesel. And in contrast to Judaism, which is completely undogmatic, and every layman can say his say, provided he quotes the right terms and the quite passages. So it's a dogmatic religion, and that I will mention three dogmas. The first is, and that is literally from Mr. Wiesel, in the beginning was Auschwitz. Now, I don't know what you know, whether you know that in the Bible, the Old Testament, such in the beginning God created heaven and earth and the waters and whatever. No. There's the new in the beginning there was Auschwitz. Okay. And then he says nothing, no suffering in the world can ever be compared with the suffering we Jews underwent in Auschwitz. And so therefore it is forbidden to compare any suffering anywhere in the world, and especially the suffering we do to the Palestinians, to compare that to things which happened in Auschwitz. And so this monopoly on suffering justifies the dispossession, and any suffering the Palestinians have to undergo due to the oppression by the Israeli occupation force and the police and what have you, because it's always a trifle as compared to what the Jews had to bear according to High Priest Wiesel. And the last thing is, well, even I am not a big believer, but I can see how blasphemy it is, because he says literally the only thing with which Auschwitz may be compared is the Sinai experience. Now, I hope many of you know what that is. When the Jews went through the desert, at a certain moment, God called on Moses to climb up the mountain Sinai, and he read him the five first books of the Torah, and Moses memorized them. And secondly, he gave him the stone tables, and with the stone tables visible, and with the Torah in his hand, in his head, he came down and gave it to the Jews in the desert. And now Mr. High Priest Wiesel says, no, the ethics of the Torah and with 1934 and with the Ten Commandments, no longer valid. The suffering of us in Auschwitz, that comes in its place. And I think it's terrible, but it's really true. Now, my interpretation of Auschwitz, and I mean, I don't say that Mr. Wiesel doesn't know what he talks about, because he has been in Auschwitz just like me, but under completely different circumstances. I was there alone, and he was with his father, and his father needed him, and then he, for one reason or the other, I once read it about it, he couldn't help him or didn't want to help him, whatever. Enough, he feels very guilty. I don't feel guilty. And because I was alone, I had only to think about myself, and I had a friend there, and we survived together. So I have no, there is a survivor's guilt, but I don't need that. But now, my interpretation of Auschwitz, my most important interpretation of Auschwitz is that only those, if a majority of, if a dominant group in a society wants to dehumanize a minority or a less powerful group in the society, they can do only so when they have been partly dehumanized, being dehumanized themselves by brainwashing to clear up some of the empathy, to wash it out, and instead bringing new values of being superhuman and the other being subhuman, etc. And so by diabolization, demonization of the other that must be learned, and only then can you try to dehumanize another group. And this is, I'm absolutely, and this is confirmed by psychiatrists, and I talk to, and it is a very ambivalent statement, because eventually it might turn this fact that large parts of the Israeli population, due to their indoctrination from kindergarten, inclusive military service, is so strong and so long, since 62 years the various generations are subject to this indoctrination, that it may eventually be the end of Zionism. Because I think that if you have large parts of the population with a diminished feeling for empathy for others, the society might turn into an unstable one, because aggressiveness is growing, and it's so growing that the other day there was an article by Yossi Sarit, a well-known Meretz former minister, who said, "I don't dare in being surrounded by people whom I do not know personally to openly talk about what I think, because I'm afraid if I do that somebody I don't know will put a knife into my chest." So that shows how aggressive it is, and you can maybe in the question time you can I can give other examples of that. Now I come to another point, and that is, and please be very careful in reading what there is, what the title is, discrimination and dehumanization between the years 1933 until 1941. That was namely a prelude to Auschwitz, because the infamous Wannsee Conference, when for the first time the industrial mass murder was planned, is from 20th of January 1942. So please, because we were accused, or I was accused, of comparing the suffering of the Palestinians with the Holocaust. No, and for me the Holocaust is Auschwitz, is a mass murder, but not the things before that time. And they can be very well compared, as I will show now. First of all, I've written a separate book about it. This one, how tragic fate is. Unfortunately, it's in German. German Jews and the effect of historical forces, and it shows how it very complex way the decision came to go to the mass murder. You can ask about it maybe also. Okay, so before 1941 there were only plans for deportation, not mass murder. And here my dear colleague Hatem mentioned already Lieberman, who is very openly, and others who very openly talk about mass deportation also in Israel. But as I mentioned before, the certainly in the region where I was born in Germany, the Nazism was not very, or the anti-Semitism was not very, very, very common, and the non-Jewish Germans knew damn well that the Jews had been their comrades. The German Jews were first of all very assimilated, and secondly, they had been good comrades in the First World War, and so the Nazis didn't even dare to start with in 33 and until 41, until during the war, because then Germany had other worries until 42. They didn't dare to start mass measures against the Jews without preparation. And the preparation contains the following elements: systematic discrimination and dehumanization of target population, so in this case the Jews, to condition dominant society to participate, or in any case to not get do anything against these mass measures. They introduced different laws for Jews and Aryans. They introduced, for the first time, arrest without warrant. They had the school books were gave a lot of indoctrination, and they had especially propaganda. I mean, that for the first time, I think, in the world, that the Nazis had a ministry of propaganda, and the Jews were compared with insects, with bacteria, with cancer, etc. So that is all belongs to this diabolization and dehumanization. And last but not least, limited or no access to education, and earning money became practically impossible, because, and so a systematic attempt at improvisation of the Jews in Germany, so that they would look shabby and uncared for, and that helps to diminish feelings of empathy which might arise if the brainwash was not yet fully 100%. Now, the as we heard also from Hatem, and as I reiterated, also in Israel, there's since many years talk about mass deportations of the Palestinians, and actually 3, 4, 5 years ago there was a letter by 100 academics in Israel, an open letter, which warned, we are afraid that our government is preparing mass deportation. But now again, the majority population, the Jews in this case in Israel, have to be prepared. And so what do we do? Different laws for Jews and Palestinians, detention without warrant, which is still from former times, is called administrative detention, and it was in my youth in Germany, it was in Nazi Germany, it's called Schutzhaft, but it's about the same thing. Systematic indoctrination from school to army, threats with deportation, shops closed, crops destroyed, and land stolen, and houses destroyed, etc. And last but not least, because that's one of the reasons why I stand here, limited or access or no access to education. And so I come to the last slide, the final conclusion. Modern Enlightenment Judaism developed in 19th and early 20th century and spread over mid-Europe and the US is humanist and universal. Political Zionism is the opposite. It is nationalistic, and I have defined political Zionism, maximum of area with minimum of Palestinians on it. It is nationalistic, exclusive, colonialist, and racist. And there is one little new hope. Young American Jews have the other day, at least certainly in New Orleans, demonstrated on a speech tour by Mr. Bibi Netanyahu, who accused the Jews of the US that they behaved such that they were delegitimizing the policies of Israel. And there they stood, the young, courageous Jews of the United States, of New Orleans in the case, with banners saying, we are not delegitimizing Israel. Israel is delegitimizing itself by their inhuman treatment of the Palestinians, their oppression, and their intrusion against international law. Thank you. Had you heard me before?
Have I heard you before?
Yeah.
I've heard you three times.
Oh, okay.
Remember?
We're going to take a few questions. It's late. It's cold. But it wouldn't be a Mecca event, even though it's only a piece of a Mecca event, if we didn't have those buckets going around. Doing a tour like this, sending Hayo and others to 11 cities around the country has cost a lot of money, and we're trying to meet those expenses. And we're asking you to give some money tonight for that, and also to help us build our water purification systems in Gaza in the schools. So please be generous. We're going to have you ask some questions. We're going to read the questions, and we'll be out of here probably pretty soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
So another, Barbara's been doing this work for over two decades and really inspired both of us with it. So please, a round of applause for Barbara. And the water project that Mecca's doing is such an important interruption of the slow-motion genocide that's happening in Palestine, so please support as you can. So we have three questions at the moment, and I wanted to add to Hayo's hope of the un-Jewish activists, of course, the 60-plus years of ongoing Palestinian resistance, and survival, as well as what's happening in the region right now. So the first question is, Saeed talks about when victims become victimizers. When you say only those who have become dehumanized can attempt to dehumanize others, I wonder how to account for U.S. military aggression and torture, one, and two, how not to be deterministic, i.e. don't want to think Palestinians will dehumanize others once they are liberated. So can you speak to this and clarify?
What was the question?
So the first question is in relationship to you first have to become dehumanized to dehumanize others. How do you account for U.S. military aggression and torture?
I think that in all, nearly all, military traditions, there is an age-old tradition of brainwashing. In order to make the soldiers prepared to kill the enemy. I remember that during the First World War, that I found an illustration in a German book where the then time Minister of Foreign Affairs of Great Britain was depicted with horns and in a dress like the devil, which with a subscript, the devil could still learn a hell of a lot from me. So this is very old tactics in nearly all military education. I mean, don't forget, the American army has Guantanamo Bay, where and torture is allowed, and has Abu Ghraib in Iraq. So there are no saints. And last but not least, once you are on the battlefield, the chances for getting roughened up, and if you have lost the camera or so, you may lose something of your empathy feelings. So it is automatic, nearly automatic process. But there was other parts to
the... And Hatem can respond to, but how do you avoid being overly deterministic? So
I don't
want to think that Palestinians will dehumanize others once they are liberated.
No, we have many examples. They try to dehumanize me. I tell you, you can reckon. They try to dehumanize me in especially obviously in Auschwitz. And I think I'm a fully 100% human being, and that's why I go on a strange lecture tour, being 86 years old, and so it's not automatic. It depends very much on the circumstances under which you live in the time of war and stress, etc. And first of all, I was very lucky in coming from a stable home, and secondly, I was lucky in that I knew the Germans very well, and to be quite frank, I survived 12 years under Hitler's regime with four Jewish grandparents, so my probability of my not being tortured was very small, but I was never tortured. So, and I think that saved much of my mental health. I checked it with psychiatrists too, and they agreed. So.
Okay.
Speaking about both combining the deterministic part and the U.S.-Belgium, I think we have to be honest with ourselves in assessing that our military has a poverty graph. Because we go and recruit in many places around the country, in particular the inner city, where people have been dehumanized in their existence, that the only way for them to come out of it is that they become a death-killing machines by engaging and becoming part of the military. And then they are at the margins in terms of their income, in terms of their resources, so they have to hold on in the military infrastructure. And once they come out of the military, they end up being often the highest numbers in the streets as homeless, because the damage that has been done to them by being in war and conflict with post-traumatic stress syndrome and so on. So in essence, that we have to think of how our military infrastructure, military industrial complex, how it's formed, and how structurally it dehumanizes people and make them machines and not thinking empathetically toward their own society, but also toward the world population in general. And that's why you could have a shock and awe and think that you're playing video games, because we already dehumanize people in such a way systematically. As far as the Palestinians and thinking that they might become victimizers, well, we can't rule out that possibility, just being a human phenomena. But at the same time, I'm really thinking of what happened in Egypt. If there's a population that could have the legitimate reason to lash out at the ruling elites, with the thousands and millions of people in the street, it would have been the Egyptians. This is a 30-year pharaoh that completely debased the basic aspect of Egypt and the Egyptians. And if you knew Egypt of the past, you would understand what took place. But nevertheless, they actually proved the whole sociological research about the deficiency of the Arab mind that we had so much been dealing with. It proved that those who were researching the Arab mind, they themselves did not have the mind to go through a CAT scan to find out whether their brain cells was firing when they were writing these materials. And therefore, we're comfortable and confident that people who rise up with empowered with consciousness can alter the basic dynamics without having to be deterministic about it. I think deterministic structures often is comes from top to bottom, and that's why you have to challenge it from the bottom up.
Okay, we have another set of questions for the speakers, but we were also asked for a concise definition of Zionism and anti-Zionism. The concise definition of Zionism was given a couple of times during this talk, but it's the political movement and ideology that resulted in the founding of the State of Israel, and that became very narrow in scope. Simply put, ultimately means maximum land in Palestine with minimum number of Palestinians, and that is based on ideology that is racist and colonialist and both white and Jewish supremacy, and it is based on policies and practices that built the State of Israel. And anti-Zionism is the movement to reject the racism and ideology of Zionism, as well as stop the implementation of its policies and practices. So, what can allies do to support Palestinian-led movements for liberation? And connected to that, what do you see peace looking like?
I see. Yesterday, the same questions about solutions, and I said, let's pray. In the sense that this asking of how peace look like, definitely we have to put some principles. One is that it has to be rooted in justice. Peace without, with the absence of justice is not peace, it's just the suspension of hostilities. And therefore, if you look at the Oslo framework, it was a framework where the Palestinians are sitting in the grave, 6 feet under, knife in their back, and then says, we have peace. That framework has to be completely changed and altered. It has to be rooted in justice. It has to be rooted in the right of return of the Palestinians. It has to be rooted in the right to their land as indigenous people. And it had to be to understand that we are living and existing on a structure of dispossession of colonization that have lasted since at least 1917, if not before. So that is the framework that we need to understand and articulate. And the first part of the question?
Is what can allies do to support allies. Palestinian-led struggle particularly?
I think first the allies have to identify where their engagement should be. We are in the United States, and therefore you have to preoccupy yourself with the policies and structures that are operable here in the United States. Often we see people preoccupy themselves 24/7 with the dynamics that are taking place in Palestine. You could argue and discuss this from now till tomorrow, you would not have helped the Palestinians in anything. What you need is to be active and build alliances in here with agenda that affect the Palestinians the most. First, you have to begin to speak about U.S. aid to Israel. That's always voted on in March. If you're not active in opposing U.S. aid to Israel, then all the speeches would not make an impact whatsoever. So, you have your iPhones or iPads. Really program it to call your congressmen, to call your persons, including here Barbara Lee. You know, she's great on opposing the war in Iraq, but I think we need to call her to speak up in March. Make phone call to congressmen to ask him about his vote on foreign aid. Just yesterday, Ron Paul is calling for opposing U.S. aid to Israel, but also wants all aid to be removed. I am actually support removing U.S. aid to Israel, because if Mubarak is the example of what we have supported in foreign aid, if Mobutu in Zaire was our foreign aid, if Allende was part of our foreign aid, we know that foreign aid is about buying maximum influence for political patronage in many of these countries. And often these leaders that are dictators, despots, that don't have democratic processes, right? And we need to actually oppose foreign aid because it's an instrument of foreign policy and manipulation of decisions. So we need to be active on that. Second, you need to support the PDS movement. Boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions. Some who speak about oh, you can't pressure the Zionists. This is not the way we need to build coalition. We need to speak to them in dialogue. No, that did not help in South Africa.
That was not the strategy in Latin America. Why do we have exceptionalism when it comes to Israel? It's a one way of trying to straddle the street, be on the right and the left, and just maintain Zionism in Israel as is. You have to maximize our work on the PDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which include not having cultural contacts, academic contacts with Israeli institutions that continue to support the infrastructure of the occupation and infrastructure of the state of Israel. So PDS is an important part. This is what the Palestinian civil society have called, and we need to actually link up and join them in that. Lastly, I know I spoke about the solution. We should not preoccupy ourselves asking the Palestinians to what is your solution. This is not what we did not ask that of the South African, nor we asked that of Central America, and we were active in that. We did not say that our conditional support is based on you articulating the answer that fulfills my need relative to supporting you. So we have to have a universal message based on justice and not frame it on these questions, which often is an answer to Israeli questions, not our own questions.
Great, thank you. Okay.
And you're in the Bay Area, where there are so many incredible efforts happening around BDS, the Bay Area Coalition to End Israeli Apartheid. You've got TAA craft campaigns, you've got US ACB, the Academic and Cultural Boycott, and you've got a campaign against the Jewish National Fund. So if you're not active, please do get involved. So this may be our last question, depending on length of responses, but this is a question to you, Dr. Wazian. As a person with a disability, I am struck by the Ben-Gurion quote characterizing camp survivors as useless human material. The T4 Nazi program targeted disabled people for extermination, referred to disabled people as useless eaters or life unworthy of life. My question. Having done research or done work on disability rights, can you discuss what work you've done and maybe what your connections are with that?
Look, I was the chairman of the National Students of Color Coalition in the 1980s and early 90s, where the ADA, the beginning of the formulation of the law, we actually lobbied Congress as a national leadership across the country. Getting the students of color to put that on their platform, getting the United States Student Association to take a blank in their platform, which I wrote personally on the ADA. Also was the first to write an environmental blank on a national level in student leadership. And I did it because in my coalition that I was leading in San Francisco, we actually had students with disability on our slate representing the full spectrum. And we felt that their contribution is as valid and as powerful as everyone else. Now, on a side note, my own cousin is in prison in Israel, has a life sentence. He's blind, and he was leading a resistance cell in Palestine. So the fact that you have a disability does not mean that you can't act on your consciousness and make a change and make an impact. And there are many examples of other Palestinians who had disabilities, including the head of Hamas, who was himself a disabled person, yet he was the leader of a movement, which for me is a sure sign that the Palestinians, even in their consciousness, was able to encompass every part of the society in their contribution without, you know, thinking about what's your position in Hamas either way. You will find that those with disabilities were included and had a very important and very powerful voice, and I think this is very important and significant for us.
Yes, thank you.
And another thing that happens with the Nazi genocide is the invisibilizing of the many, many, many people who were killed by the Nazis, and people with disabilities are often invisibilized around that history. So thank you, Jack. So the last question I will combine is on Islamophobia, which one is the question about the ways in which Islamophobia masquerades as either libertarianism or atheism, particularly also in the left. And then that what's happening around the hijab in Europe, could that happen here?
Well, I said these individuals from the US and Europe are meeting. All these right-wing organizations are meeting. Interestingly, in Europe, some of these who are leading the charge against the Muslims in Europe are the ones that just a few years back were part of the right-wing skinheads neo-Nazi groups. Now they have identified a collective and linked arm in relations to Muslims, and they're phrasing their arguments in clearly very racist terms. You know, take the law that was passed in Europe, and just, you know, we had a meeting, we took a delegation, met with the French ambassador on this issue, and we posed the question because his claim that the law says no ostentatious religious symbolism should be present in public space, in schools and at the universities. And the target was Muslim women with hijab. And I said, well, let me ask you, I'm just going to ask you a question. I said, you're going to be celebrating Christmas, and I know that all of the streets of Paris and the Champs-Élysées will be decorated with lights, and those lights are supported by taxpayers in your state. That is ostentatious religious symbolism. And I know your president is going to be sending out greeting cards for Christmas, and that is ostentatious representation of religious symbolism. I don't want you to stop. I want to encourage you to do it, but you need to realize that the Muslims are subsidizing your ostentatious religious symbolism. Right? Furthermore, the public sector takes a holiday throughout the whole from December 23rd all the way to January 1st. The minority are subsidizing your ostentatious religious symbolism. I want you to realize that we're happy that we're paying for your celebration, right, religiously, but to say that the only representation of ostentatious religious symbolism within the society is only the hijab is misunderstanding your own society. Furthermore, every week you take off Saturday and Sunday. Why don't you take Wednesday and Thursday off? Why is it Saturday and Sunday? Isn't it that ostentatious representation of religion by time making it religious in a secular state? I don't want you to stop, but I want you to understand that your selection of ostentatious religious symbolism is self-selective because you're targeted against a minority that you see it threatening your own space that wants to be once again exclusive. So these are issues that right now is being presented in here. It's been right now, if you are a Muslim woman with a hijab, now in many parts of the DMPs in the south, in Oklahoma and other places, now a Muslim woman is not allowed to take a picture with a hijab. So that's when we're already seeing some of these push. And the meetings that are taking place are strategic meetings between these individuals of how to use local level policies and ordinances to limit these freedoms. Now, if you have a problem with Islam and religion, once again, it's a religious institution, it has its own problem. But differentiate between critiquing Islam and religion in general in a normative way versus using religion and antagonism and Islamophobia as a way to demonize the person that believes in religion. For example, you could go to work and you could believe whatever you want, but you don't have a whole structure of demonizing that is set at the highest level of our government and targeted against those individuals. And that's where the difference between critiquing Islam in general, critiquing some of the policies, or critiquing countries. I have no problem. If you critique 55 Muslim countries, I'll join you much more, because I am like one of the most vehement critics of almost every Muslim country. So before people discovered that Mubarak was a pharaoh, I already have written more about the pharaoh than the pharaoh himself known. All of a sudden, the American public and Obama and Clinton know that Mubarak is a dictator. You mean that when we were doing the extraordinary rendition and the CIA picked up somebody from the streets of Rome, delivered him to Egypt for torture with our CIA watching, all of a sudden just discovered that he's a dictator just last week? Just give me a break. Right? So if you want to critique, we could critique it, but differentiate between Islamophobia, which you're targeting the individual, versus critiquing a religion, a faith that has its own history and its own development, its own discourses.
A very short note. I once want to reiterate again that the way in which people try to demonize Muslims is very similar to the way I was demonized. And secondly, unfortunately, and that is what I can talk about, is in my country, we have this Wilders chap, and I can assure you, he is part of the parliament, and in a way, it has also, it is part of the government actually. And I can assure you that in his room, in the room where he and his parliament members come together, there are two pictures. One of the infamous fascist Israeli Vladimir Jabotinsky, and the other is and I think and of Netanyahu also. So now you know that at least in the Islamophobia in Europe, which country plays a pushing role there?
Thank you.
So thank you for hanging in and for joining us tonight. Please join me in another round of applause for our speakers.